Hello and welcome to On Geopolitics, the podcast that looks at geopolitics in historical context with myself, Ali Ansari, and my colleague, Suzanne Rain. So, Suzanne, today we have an interesting discussion going on. You might like to introduce our two guests we have. We have a bonus this week. We have two guests. Who are they?
Yes, and Ali, I'd like to say I think they're always interesting, but this one hopefully will be really interesting. So we are joined very happily by Dr. Rinad Mansour and Dr. Zimkan Ali, both from the Royal Institute of International Affairs, otherwise known as Chatham House. Rinad is Senior Research Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa Programme, and Zimkan is Associate Fellow. And they're joining us because they are in the process of finalising a paper about Sinjar. And this, Ali, I hope you will appreciate, this is very much in the theme of our recent conversation about, in order to understand what's going on in the macro geopolitical level, you actually need to know what's going on in particular geographic locations. And Sinjar, they're going to show us, is a really wonderful case study of how important it is to understand what's going on the ground. So I'm going to turn to Rinad first, I think, who's going to explain what he's been looking at, what they've been looking at, and what they've found.
Thank you. Thanks, Suzanne and Ali. It's a pleasure to be doing this podcast with you. Essentially, the question that Zimkan and I are looking into, is the Middle East, the region that we cover, seems to increasingly be becoming transnational. It's hard for to see conflict confined to the national boundaries or borders of these states, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. You're seeing what many are referring to as regional escalation. And you're seeing attacks all over the region as part of the same conflict. So at Chatham House, we have a project known as ACCEPT, Cross-Border Conflict Evidence Policy Trends. And this project, funded by the FCDO, is really trying to help policymakers develop the tools to be able to better approach and respond to conflicts when they erupt. And so what Zimkan and I decided to do was to find a geographical area where, you know, it may seem like a small, tiny city or a district, but it has implications across the region. And Sinjar became the case study that we decided for several reasons. First of all, Sinjar is probably one of the most violent, contested areas in the so-called post-ISIS sort of region. So although there's been a liberation of ISIS, although sort of people are talking about stabilization, Sinjar is very much still engulfed in conflict. Many, many armed groups continue to fight for control over the territory, but also hundreds of thousands of IDPs have yet to return to Sinjar. And so you have this violent political economy rising from this tiny, tiny district in northwestern Iraq. And the question we had really was why? Why Sinjar? Why is Sinjar so geographically valuable to so many groups? You have two big groups in Sinjar. One is the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, which uses Sinjar, Iraq, to fight its wars in Syria and Turkey. So here you already see how transnational that is. But then you have another set of actors, the Popular Mobilization Forces. Some of these are known as the Iran-allied resistance fighters, which again use Sinjar for their fight, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria and the Levant. So you have so much going on in Sinjar, sort of in this kind of like inside-out model, but also, of course, the outside-in comes in because you have all of these transnational actors looking at Sinjar. The way we wanted to illustrate this was looking at a supply chain, and a specific supply chain, which is military. A lot of high-grade military equipment and people, our soldiers, are transported back and forth by these two groups for the purposes of their transnational conflicts. So that's sort of, in broad strokes, the paper that we're looking at, and essentially to develop what can the UK or Europeans or Americans who work in stabilization, who work in conflict response, do when a conflict is so transnational?
Thanks, Rinad. So can I then ask Zimkan to take us back a step and just tell the listener who might not be completely certain exactly where Sinjar is and why it's different. So we will have all heard about it in 2014 when Daesh or ISIS overwhelmed it, drove out or massacred the Yazidis, who I think are the majority population there. But apart from that, it's probably not a terribly well-known part of the world at all. So tell us what it's like.
Yeah, thank you. So as Renat described it, it's a tiny district, Iraqi district, but actually its location that makes it so important and significant for transnational group. It's a district located at the west of Iraq's Nineveh governorate at the border with Syria. And it's very close to Turkey from the Turkish southern borders. It provides access to both Syria and Turkey and to Iraq. And that makes it very strategically significant for groups like the PKK and the PMF that have operation across these different territories. Because of the presence of these groups, Sanjar is quite militarized. So the district itself comprises different towns spread around Sanjar Mountain. So you have part of the main cities and town located at the north of Sanjar Mountain and other parts located at the south of Sanjar Mountain. And with Sanjar Mountain being an area where there are still inhabitants in addition to local militant groups tied to both the PMF and the PKK, and the mountain extends right into the Syrian border. And this is home to what is important and interesting about Sanjar is a ethnically and religiously mixed place in Iraq where you can find Kurds, Shia, Sunnis, but also it's home to Iraq's Yazidi minority. The largest numbers of the Yazidis are concentrated in Sanjar. So our story about the transnationalization of the conflict in Sanjar started with ISIS. August 2014, ISIS occupied the city, committed serious crimes against the Yazidi community and depopulated the area. And in the name of liberating Sanjar and its people from ISIS, both the PMF and the PKK moved in and took root in there and have, as Renat said, used it and utilized it as a transit route for moving militias and weapons across different territories in the region.
Can I just ask, I mean, looking at your paper and this sort of fascinating account of what Sinjar represents as this sort of microcosm of this, you know, very complex dynamic going on in the region, and one which, you know, as we study, really one that doesn't respect, you know, what we would call international boundaries or stated international boundaries. Is the actual place itself, is there a sort of a modus operandi between these different groups? Or are they constantly contested? I mean, is it an area where there is sort of fighting going on, or is it one in which these different groups or different factions are basically operating, you know, not in conjunction with each other, but, you know, tolerating each other? I mean, how does it work on a sort of a day-to-day basis?
Well, you're right. There's both competition and contestation. After ISIS, it was the PKK, really, the sort of the Kurdish Workers Party that fights its fight against Turkey, that became the dominant player. So the popularization forces and their access of resistance allies, those Iran-allied groups, were actually using a different border point, and Al-Qa'im. But that border point ended up being in the desert. And, you know, American drones find it easy to attack many of their locations, as we've seen across the border in Al-Qa'im. And so increasingly, as they're developing more sophisticated weaponry for their military fight, they're looking for more secure ways of transportation. And this is where they see Sinjar. Sinjar, the geography matters. And Sinjar is, as Zimkan and I are saying, it's mountainous. And so being able to transport both valuable goods, but also fighters, you know, with better security from, let's say, drones that could attack them, became an important consideration. And so what you're seeing now is that negotiation between the groups. We're not, you know, at the moment, oftentimes they ally with each other, they work together, but sometimes they compete with each other. And so I think, you know, and Zimkan could come in on this, but really what we're looking for as we look into the future is at what point will these groups start to really negotiate who controls what? But if, you know, if you're driving through Sinjar right now, you know, you go through one checkpoint, which is one group. A few meters down, you go through another checkpoint, which is another group. So it's this, you know, it's this heterogeneous area with all of these different groups all vying for control. And yes, of course, this is all negotiated, but you do have flare-ups.
Yeah, just to add what Renat said about the who controls what right now and the type of the alliances in Sinjar between these different groups. So the balance of power shifted many times in favor of different groups. But since 2017, when the Kurdistan Regional Government, the Iraqi Kurds, held a referendum of independence, that resulted in the removal of the KRG or the Kurdish forces from Sinjar. And since then, the balance of power shifted in favor of both the PMF and the PKK, who are not natural allies. They are both ideologically and politically different. The PMF is Iran-backed. They're driven by religious Shia ideology. The PKK is driven by a mix of communist ideology and Kurdish nationalism. But what brings them together in this small place is to prevent the KDP, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and its allies in Turkey to come back and regain control over the district. So it's a tactical alliance that serves both actors' interests. Now, the Iraqi Kurds, the formal political parties here, especially the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the most powerful one, aligned with Turkey, against the PKK and tries to use different resources from Baghdad, from the international community to remove the PKK and the PMF from the area, but has not been successful so far because the PMF has greater leverage in the government in Iraq, in Baghdad, and has greater resources to protect its position and supports the PKK there.
So one of the things that you say right up in the beginning of your paper, which I think is a really helpful way to frame it, is you're looking at an arena for conflict which stems from somewhere else, in a way, from distant geographies, beyond its borders. And that's why, so what you're talking about here is, so the PKK and the PMF, they're not fighting each other. They both have a conflict essentially somewhere else, that this is a useful strategic point for. And you make very clearly the contrast between that, where you have an external agenda or a conflict being brought into a place, really, from those essentially where you have the conflict is in the place and projects outward. So we're looking, I think, at this really interesting one where the conflicts are somewhere else, but this is the arena where it's being fought. And so now I would like you, as we're still in the explanatory phase here, so we all sort of think we've stopped talking about ISIS and we've kind of stopped thinking about all the people whose lives were completely destroyed by ISIS. And I think, I mean, most of Sinjar's people are still displaced or in temporary camps. I mean, what is life like if you're an ordinary person living in Sinjar at the moment? Are people still in vast refugee camps or what?
Okay, so yes, especially people from the Yazidi background, the largest majority of them live at camps at the neighboring Duhok province, which is a Kurdish province in the Iraqi Kurdistan. Those who have returned face everyday difficulties because the place is militarized. There are no guarantees that you wouldn't be targeted by one of these militias on the ground. So as Renat described, when you go there, you go through checkpoints, you see these militias taking position in different places across the district with their own flags, with their own insignia. The Iraqi federal forces are there, but do not have the power of applying rules and protecting people there. But also the measures taken by the Iraqi government and the Kurdistan regional government to contain the PMF and the PKK, they are applying strong measures through checkpoints, not allowing essentials to arrive in Sinjar and restricting mobility. That affects the livelihoods and the economies of the people. Also, the presence of the PKK has invited Turkish attack. So since 2020, Turkey has stepped up its air and drone attacks against the leaders in the positions of the local allies of the PKK, and that generates insecurity and prevents the people to return to their homes. And the Iraqi government has been weak in terms of providing services and reconstructing the area. You go to the central Sinjar city, it's still in ruins. it's destroyed completely. And the Iraqi government has failed to rebuild. So people are hopeless, most of them. And those who return, they don't have any option but to join one of those militias. And not everyone wants to do that.
So there is a policy conundrum here. There is a lot of money being spent in programming, whether it's the UN, the EU, national governments, the US, the UK, specifically on Sinjar. So there is an appreciation that Sinjar is a microcosm of conflict across the region, but also it's a boiling place. It's a place where conflict could sort of tip over. However, there is a fundamental mismatch that we see from attempts to stabilize Sinjar, to get the IDPs back, to make life better. First of all, I'll give you one example that we looked at in the paper, which is the Iraqi government said, okay, we know that Sinjar is being used by these transnational armed groups. We have an idea taken from another president. Let's build a wall. And the Iraqi government built a wall along the border between Iraq and Syria. Okay. This was a way to try and confine the conflict in a way to stop the transnational nature of it.
Reyno, can I stop? Can I just do it? Because this is so astonishing. What do you mean a wall? I mean, where have they built this? I mean, what, the entire border or just a part of the border?
Not the entire border. It's a long stretch, but yeah. Most of the border, yeah, it's quite a long wall and along the Iraqi-Syrian border.
Wow. And,
you know, so we started to look at it. We started to look at, okay, what has this wall actually done? You know, and we saw that, okay, these groups, these transnational armed groups, they found ways around the wall, as one would expect.
Funny that.
However, the sort of the sad irony to this is that it's actually essential goods and basic goods, medicine, food, that's the stuff that's being stopped because of the wall, not, you know, the weapons and the armed groups that are linked to the elites. So it has backfired in a way, and there's created a further humanitarian problem where Sinjar is even more closed and even more securitized because of this policy. So that was from the Iraqi government. There's been another sort of attempt by the UN in particular, but internationals, to come up with what became known as the Sinjar Agreement. And the Sinjar Agreement, it was a negotiated settlement between the government of Iraq and the KRG, the KDP, the Kurdistan the Democratic Party. It included neither the PMF nor the PKK, the two groups that actually we've been talking about who control this. So again, you can see this is another way indirectly to build a border, to say, no, this is an Iraq conflict. And so it must be Iraqi parties that are part of the mediation. And so what we're essentially saying is this conflict, the parties' interests in it are transnational. Doubling down on these borders, whether it's literally by building a wall or creating a dialogue only to the people who are within those borders, is not working.
So this question of defining national boundaries and saying if it's in Iraq, this is an Iraqi conflict, if it's in, I mean, clearly that ship left a long time ago. But there is still a sense, isn't there, that it is a part of the Iraqi state. And this is where the ineffectiveness of the Iraqi government to police itself, it becomes so striking. Because as you said, I mean, there have been attempts, I think they've been trying, I'm just looking here, Article 140 of Iraq's 2005 constitution defines Sinjar as one of Iraq's disputed territories. I mean, it's what we were talking about the other day, Ali, about the frozen conflicts. Just we all just think, well, we can't really fix this, so let's just kind of leave it, and then one day, hopefully, it'll go away. And there are others like Kashmir, which is a fantastically long example of that, where we're kind of hoping that one day it will fix itself. But I think what you're saying here at heart is that is this something that the Iraqi government is never going to be able to fix on its own, because it's not a problem that's within a state. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So exactly. So what we are saying is that because it's transnationalized and there are groups involved in this with allies and influence beyond the borders, and what happens in Syria in the Kurdish enclave called Rojava, where PKK developed influence, what happens there actually impacts upon and influences the security and political dynamics in Sinjar itself. So Renat talked about the border wall that the Iraqi government built to cut the connection between the allies of the PKK on both sides of the border. So once Iraqi government did that, the people on the other side of this border started to challenge this and demonstrate it and continue helping cross-border activities of these groups. So what we are saying is that the Iraqi government, because it doesn't have control over even the PMF, so the Popular Mobilization Forces, is a part of the Iraqi state in theory or formally, but they are actually acting independently most of the time, including when they have interests that, you know, are incompatible with the Iraqi interests, external interests. So they are part of the Iran's axis of resistance, while the formal Iraqi government in Baghdad may not support these activities. So what we are saying is that there needs to be a transnational approach to this problem, even bringing Turkey and some of the local allies of the PKK to the table, both inside Sinjar and in Syria, because then when you give them a seat on the table, because they're powerful on the ground, then they can support in implementing any form of settlement. Otherwise, you will be in a situation where you have the Sinjar agreements and the powerful actors on the ground will prevent any implementation. So the Sinjar agreement was about a new administration. It was about removing all the militias on the ground. And it was about reconstructing Sinjar. None of these happened because the Iraqi government and the KRG or the Kurdistan regional government, they do not have influence on the ground.
Can I ask? Well, I had two questions for you. I mean, one particular, one more general. One is that to what extent is this sort of situation in Sinjar replicated in other parts of Iraq or even, you know, other parts in Syria and whatever? I mean, to what extent is this a problem that is basically a problem, and this is the more general question, I suppose, in a way, of the center versus the periphery, that this is an ability of the state to be able to control its, you know, its major urban centers and their immediate hinterland, but not much else. I mean, you know, they're not able to really maintain a control. So in the senses we would understand it, in terms of the modern state or the post, you know, 1919 state system, whatever, these are not states in that sense. They are actually more akin to our 19th century brethren, in a sense, where the state has a control over the arteries, you know, the major highways, arteries, cities, but actually very little control over much else. This is what this represents. It's a sort of a breakdown of that settlement, in actual fact, a breakdown of the aspiration, shall we say, post, I don't know, 1919 or post 45 or whatever you want to call it, of having sort of a modern state system in the Middle East. So, I mean, to what extent does, you know, the particular reflect a wider problem, and to segue onto the bigger question as well?
I mean, one way to look at it is center-periphery, but another way to look at it is Sinjar actually reveals what the Iraqi state actually looks like. So it's the centrality of the periphery where you're actually seeing what the state is. And I think that's really important about Sinjar and why we think it is a microcosm. So it is not to say that, you know, there isn't power even in Baghdad or in the KRG, but it is to say that state power isn't confined to government institutions. And the same can be said across the country. So it's true that Sinjar is remote. It's true that because of its, you know, there's a reason why geographically being on the borders of Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and also between domestic border between Iraq and Kurdistan makes Sinjar contested, for sure. But it shows you what the Iraqi state actually looks like. And so when we think about what needs to be done in this idea of frozen conflict, certainly the Sinjar conflict has transformed. So, you know, you cited Article 140. When the constitution was being written, it was the government of Iraq and the Kurdistan regional government that were the two parties to the dispute. And there was this effort at the time, after 2003, to strengthen these groups, to say these are the two parties to the dispute and the disputed territories between these two national parties. What ISIS did was completely demolish the pretense that you have these nation-state borders, right? ISIS very famously showed how ineffective the borders are. And now what you have with the rise of these groups that are more transnational, that are using Sinjar as a base for wider conflicts, is the inability of state actors, here I'm using states, you know, government actors, to exert influence. And reality, you have to look into a broader set of society to understand where power actually resides.
Just to add to what Renat said about the nature of the Iraqi state and the center periphery, actually, it's about the nature of the political parties that emerged post-2003. I mean, in respect to the Kurdish parties, it was even before 1991, where you have political parties acting like mini states, having their own private militias, armed forces, and control over economic assets, territories, border crossings. So in the KRI, what you have in Iraqi Kurdistan is two parties that divided the region into two zones of political, economic, and territorial control. And the same applies to the rest of Iraq. You have Shia influential parties with their own militias, with their own groups, capturing state institutions and the border crossings, economic assets, oil fields, and so on and so forth. So it's really actually difficult to say where the state is in Iraq in the light of the presence of this type of political parties here. And also the last thing here is just to make it clear, the Article 140 was not just about Sinjar, it's about a stretch of territories that extends right from the border of Iran to Sinjar and passes through major cities like the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. And this, both the Iraqi government and the Kurdish parties failed to come up with a solution to this problem.
So you've kind of got you've got one massive post-conflict failure, but within it you've got two post-conflict, post-Saddam Hussein conflict and a failure to have prevented it sinking into warlordism, you know, corruption, all the rest of it. And then the post-caliphate phase, which is the bit I think that Sinjar is particularly a focus of, where again, failure really quickly to sort that out has meant the building up of, again, kind of, you know, local power centres and structures and let's call them warlords for want of a better term. So the question is, I mean, you wouldn't be here if you had planned it, but given that you didn't, we are where we are. And I think what you're saying is nothing is going to be possible unless all the various actors are drawn into a conversation, which means talking to the PKK and the PMF, both of whom have obviously, I assume, totally different agendas and interests. So do you go so far as to recommend what the approach would be?
Part of it is, yes, trying to understand, you know, to speak to authority. And at the end of the day, you know, one of the problems in the Middle East in general has been this idea that authority and a statesperson needs to kind of sit in a specific institution, in a government, a minister, a prime minister. But the reality is much more sort of porous than that, let's say, or much more blurred than that. So ensuring that everyone in the room is representing social power. And as with the paper documents, this will necessarily mean including groups that are like the PMF or the PKK. However, that's not enough. And, you know, there's been a lot that the UK and other governments have pushed on elite bargains, this idea to bring all elites together. A key sort of dynamic that needs to complement this is accountability. Accountability to local structures and accountability to local populations. This has been missing. And a key driver of conflict isn't just to make sure that everyone can come in and divide the pie amongst each other and to stop conflict. That might stop the kind of direct conflict, but how do you sort of address some of the structural forms of conflict? And that is to ensure that not only are these groups coming together, but they are building institutions, building rule of law, and removing the impunity that they have always enjoyed. And that's the challenge. That's the big goal that, you know, where can the UK, the US, others in their international state programming, international state building programming, be able to exert more leverage to say, okay, it's not enough just to put everyone on the table. There needs to be a plan, a roadmap for building institutions that could uphold the rule of law and to kind of begin to address issues like corruption or other issues that aren't necessarily on the table when we're just trying to get out of a civil war situation.
That sounds very sensible. Do you think it's at all likely? I mean, are there enough people on each side of this that see that as being desirable?
I think what we are saying specifically about Sinjar right now is we are aiming for a form of stability first, because as we started in the paper, we are looking at the most volatile part of Iraq, which does not have a semblance of stability that you could see it in the rest of Iraq right now. is to return the government. It doesn't have a local government. When the KRG was removed in 2017 from Sanjar, all government employees and administrators who were KDP allies or Kurdish allies, they went to the Hague. They are not now operating from there. So there is no legitimate authority, public authority in the region. For us, this is about removing multiple armed militias in this tight place and giving security file to an accountable force is about reconstruction of destroyed place. So what we are aiming for is about a specific place in Iraq. Whether it is possible to build institutions, take another step, and what Renard is saying, prevent what we call in Iraq a party quota system or muhasasa, as the local term is, that can come later. When you have it in the rest of Iraq, then you can go to a most volatile place in Iraq and apply it.
And to respond to the very difficult question of, okay, you've identified the problem and you've criticized it, but how likely is this solution? I think that's a really important question. And I guess what we're trying to say with the paper is there needs to be a bit more outside the box thinking. And part of that outside the box thinking is actually thinking transnationally. So where are there leverage points? Where are there, you know, potential ways in which the UK or the US might have allies, you know, in Syria or in Turkey, for example, that may be important ways of brokering a bit more leverage? So it's about creating a sort of mapping of all the networks and how they're all connected, and then identifying areas in which there could be a push. And what we found often, in, you know, especially in Iraq since 2003, is that both the US and UK have fallen short on leveraging their allies. They've fallen short. It's always been a military kind of victory, but with no real end state in sight, nor a kind of strategy that could develop. So part of what we're arguing here is, yes, they're allies, but there is more influence that can be exerted to ensure accountability and to push for stabilization, which, as you know, is a very big file with a huge budget in many Western countries.
I mean, I have to say, just to follow on from Suzanne's earlier point, I think it's very bold. I think it's very ambitious what you're trying to do. I mean, I think when times were good, it would have been quite ambitious. I think now that times are bad, it's going to be even more difficult to achieve some of these things. But nonetheless, I can see how you're trying to sort of, you know, articulate a way in which a solution could be found. But I, you know, one of the things I suppose that, you know, it gets me thinking is whether the people there actually want a solution to be found. I mean, you know, this is the other thing. For it to actually work, you need a desire for there to be a solution. And I often wonder whether they do. You know, I wonder whether it works very well. Yeah, carry on.
I think Renard made me think about this. And you go back to your framing. There are arenas for a conflict stemming from distant geographies beyond the country borders, sort of outside in. And so the question, exactly as Ali's asked, but the question is, why does PKK exist? It exists because it's fighting Turkey. Why does the PMF exist? It exists because it's projecting forwards for Iraq stroke Iran into Syria. So kind of what you're saying by definition is, for as long as those conflicts continue to exist, these groups are going to be bringing the conflict back to Sinjar because that's their helpful place where they can move. Well, it's this bit where they can move stuff, where they can hide in the mountains and all the rest of it. So until there's some sense that the PKK don't have to be PKK anymore or Syria is fixed, they're going to continue to be there, aren't they? Is that the
challenge is that conflict, if, you know, as the conflict in the region, as seen in Washington or seen in London, is confined to national borders.
Yes.
And so if you think about something like the joint assessments, conflict and stabilize, you know, the assessments that the UK government does, it's the Iraq team that's focusing on Sinjar, not the Lebanon team, even though the Lebanon team might be linked to this or the Turkey team might be linked to this, right? So there's a structural issue that we're trying to raise here, which is to think transnationally necessarily means having a dialogue across conflict advisors and across government officials who may be working on a specific file, but might actually have something to say on a file, you know, a few countries away, or might actually have someone who could be an important broker for a conflict somewhere away. So it's trying to get governments to move past, you know, I know that there is now a realization that these borders are porous and conflict goes across, but it's surprising still how governments are confined to the national borders. And it's that that we're trying to push the envelope.
It's, I mean, you know, it sounds like what you're asking for, Eno, is joined up thinking. I mean, it's a difficult one, right? I mean, the thing is, and you're absolutely right. I mean, on that point, I mean, I think it's, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, I remember, you know, post 9/11, this obsession almost that Afghanistan belonged to South Asia. And therefore, nobody could actually deal with Afghanistan who might look at it from a Persian perspective, an Iranian perspective. Yeah. I mean, it was these sort of categorizations that were so rigid and so fixed. And as you quite rightly say, I think people tend to view these things in categories, you know, so that even the Iranians in Iraq, you know, it was this sort of idea of, you know, this is the Arab world and therefore, you know, what the hell are these people doing here? I mean, it doesn't really work. And I entirely agree with you, this sort of idea that you must have a much more coherent and transnational, you know, debate about this. But it's interesting that we're finding it quite difficult to step outside this sort of national boundaries thinking, you know, the state system in a very, you know, what would you call it, vulgar IR setup, if I can be so bold. But it is quite striking.
Ali always has to make a point about how international relations is studied. And I just go with it because...
Yeah, because obviously applied history is the way forward.
So well done, Ali.
Applied history is the way forward, as you will know in Cambridge and St. Andrews. But I think you're right. I mean, I think the central point you're making is a vital one and a crucial one. It's one that I think, you know, Suzanne and I have been making for some time. I think others too. It's interesting. What I find fascinating about your work is you've picked a very particular case. And a very interesting particular case to highlight this wider problem. And I think it's all the better, you know, in a sense for doing that. You're showing something specific, but actually the problem is a much, much wider one, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Just going back to the question Ali asked, that is anyone on the ground wants a solution or a settlement? Mm. I think one actor would, I admit, the community, the society, the people themselves, on both sides of the border, especially in Sinjar, right? It's true, they're divided, captured by these different groups, but still there are hopes, many people on the ground, that they want to go back to normality, that they want peace, that they want life, that they want a district free of militias, tensions, cross-border activities. And one of the main ideas is for the international community to work with the society, with the community, with the civil society actors on both sides of the border, not just in Sinjar, but also in what we call it Rojava or the Syrian Kurdistan. There are people there that they would like to develop their own society, that they would like to participate in peace settlements, that they would like to see their areas free of tensions and militias.
I suspect there are areas closer to home that Britain may be able to take their experiences, which might help in explain, you know, this idea that you have militias, quote, you know, violent factions who have a vested interest in keeping things going, but actually wider civil society clearly wants to have a better dialogue. And I mean, obviously, one of the ways is to improve the economic livelihood for many of the people in the region and give them a vested interest, you know, in that. Because at the moment, I presume quite a few of them are making their livelihoods out of this chaos.
Yeah, I mean, the supply chains going across is a big reason why some tiny place like Sinjar could be so important and strategic. But at the same time, public pressure, although the trend towards authoritarianism and these sort of different groups that are establishing themselves across the region, public pressure can still matter. And the livelihoods is really important. And that, as Zimkan says, has to be the key for building any type of sustainable programming. So although, you know, we have been discussing the need to bring all elites together, these elites need to be responsive and representative of society. And that is, of course, the harder issue, but it has to be the conversation that is being had.
So we've got about a minute left. One of you is going to say, what do you hope happens as a result of your paper?
Yes, is to renegotiate the Sinjar agreement by bringing in both the community, members of the community, the civil society, as well as the local allies of the PMF and the PKK on the ground. In that way, things might go into the right direction. And when you exclude the community, when you exclude these powerful forces on the ground, then you wouldn't have any hope for any agreement to be implemented, for the Baghdad government to think beyond building walls and to respond to the economic concerns, the security concerns of the people of Sanjar and the international community, to shift focus to bringing in the main players in Syria into this, especially those within the Syrian Democratic Forces that can influence the interaction at the border between Sinjar and Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I think very briefly, ultimately, the people of Sinjar still haven't returned home. And the longer that they stay in these camps, the more the likelihood of further conflict. And not only that, you know, Sinjar is now key in the regional escalation that we're seeing after October 7th. I know we didn't mention this, but several of the armed groups see Sinjar as the launching pad for any strikes against Israel, for example, if they've said this. Yeah. And this goes back all the way to Saddam Hussein's time. So the trend seemed to be going towards even more escalation and Sinjar being a conflict of even more of a problem in the region. What we're trying to do is say, this needs to be solved. The longer this is left to fester, the more problematic it will be, and the harsher the cycles of conflict will be.
Yeah, it's true that during Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, Saddam fired rockets from Sinjar at Israel, which is the highest and the closest point from Israel. And they want to replicate that. They hinted towards that.
Okay, we should have obviously brought that in earlier, but at the same time, let's leave people wanting more. Thank you, Renaud Mansour and Zimkhan Ali, for your fascinating paper and your beautiful exposition of it in our conversation. So we've really enjoyed talking to you.
And we should say, when is it due out?
It hopefully will be out at some point in March.
Excellent. Great. Okay, so just in case listeners are raring for, which I'm sure they are.
Keep an eye out, and yes, it'll be coming through Chatham House.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.